Hello, everyone, and welcome back to another episode of Shuttlepod at the Disco. And this is Shuttlepod at the Disco episode number 13, which corresponds to Star Trek Discovery episode number 14, which is the episode we're going to talk about today. Episode number 14 is called The War Without, The War Within. It was written by Lisa Randolph and directed by David Solomon. I'm Kaylee Iacovino, and I'm joined today by my friends Jared Whitley.
Good afternoon, everyone.
And Brian Drew.
Hey, everybody. Welcome back, Kayla.
Thanks. Good to be back.
We missed you.
So, Jared, why don't you give us a quick synopsis? What was episode number 14 about?
Well, you know, if I could describe it, back on the USS Discovery, Michael Burnham and the crew are faced with the harsh reality of the war during their absence. In order to move forward, Starfleet must use unconventional tactics and sources to take their next action against the Klingons.
Dun, 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 dun.
Have you noticed it's always unconventional tactics, right? They never use conventional tactics.
Yeah, that would be boring. That would be so conventional.
Yeah, but presumably they become a convention because they are effective, right? Anyway, I don't know.
True, but it doesn't really make an interesting story when they're like, oh, we just did, you know, evasive maneuver pattern, Delta Echo 13,
Echo Papa 607,
and then shot a couple of photon torpedoes, and the end, we won.
Mm-hmm. Good point, you're right, I was wrong.
So, all right, let's do our typical round the table, just quick reactions to episode 14, The War Without, The War Within. Brian, let's start with you. What did you think of this episode of Star Trek Discovery?
I thought it was a regression for the show. I think we all agree, even though we may not have liked all the elements that occurred in the Mirror Universe, it was probably the strongest stretch of episodes that the show had had. And they get back to the Prime Universe, and this show just kind of... It's hard to really describe what I'm feeling about it. It just feels like a lot of the threads that were carried forward earlier seem to be either getting dropped or moved around, or I did not enjoy it. Let me put it that way.
You know what it felt like to me? It felt like an episode of The Office after Michael had left. Right?
Where sort of without direction?
Yes. Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What'd you guys think?
Yeah, what do you think, Jared? If you have any more thoughts?
Okay, the phrase that came to my mind as I was watching it was that they haven't earned this, right? They haven't earned a big, amazing climax. And because of that, when they're trying to do a big, amazing climax, they're kind of fumpering around and they're not able to do it.
Sure.
It definitely felt like a setup for the next episode.
Sure.
Like almost like they were treading water to get to the finale.
Well, and we know that a couple of episodes were added late in the game.
Yes, so, these two episodes were added late.
Yeah, so it was originally, 13 episodes the whole first season, and then it was extended to 15. And, you know, I feel like this episode and, frankly, the last episode were a couple of the weaker ones that, like, where maybe it's like they were stretching just to, like, fill in. Yeah, I think I have to echo kind of what you guys have said. Brian, I think you hit on one of the things that stands out for me is that I feel like there's all these threads that, all these narrative threads that they've been weaving throughout the whole season. And I feel like a lot of those have either been cut short in a very strange way where they've, like, ended some thread without, like, not in a satisfying way, or they have so many threads open that are like things that need to be resolved and there's one episode left.
Yeah.
And I don't know that they can do it. And so I don't understand, like, maybe it's partly the Trekkie in me, you know, one of the things I want to see resolved is I want to understand why no one can ever use spore drive technology again after Discovery.
Oh, sure.
Because we know that happens and that's the biggest probably thing, you know, hole, if you will, in canon that needs to be repaired before they can move on. And so I'm like, all right, at the end of season one, they're going to, but they've had like several chances to close that hole.
In this episode, there's the idea that the spore drive is dangerous. It continues to parallel dimensions and then it all gets burned up. And we're like, okay, the spores are a limited resource and now they're gone. It's like, oh no, wait, then they make a lot in 3 minutes.
Yeah, we're going to talk about that for sure.
Okay. Okay. Sorry. Don't mean to.
No. It's all right. Please. It's all right. But yeah. So, all right. I mean, any other thoughts before we move on to moving through the episode specifically?
No, let's do it.
Okay. Okay, so there were essentially two, maybe two and a half stories happening throughout the episode, right? So we had the Tyler and Burnham narrative, and that was interesting because that was something that was left unresolved two episodes ago. So it was nice to finally see at least something happened with that. And then there was the Admiral Cornwell's story and things with Mira Giorgio. And then the maybe half, or I guess you could call it the third story that was going on was, although it didn't have a lot of screen time, was Stamets and the Spore regeneration and that kind of stuff. So
right.
Figure we can go through sort of one by one and talk about each of these.
Let's do it.
So first up would be the Tyler Burnham story that was happening. And I think there were a lot, for me, there were a lot of really good moments. And there, for me, there are also a lot of really bad moments.
Mm-hmm. I cared about this scene so little that I actually skipped it.
Seriously?
Yeah, I did. I did. I'm like, I don't need
Wow.
to.
You mean the one between Burnham when she walks in and speaks with Tyler in whatever room that was?
Yeah, I just jumped ahead, and when I realized it wasn't done, I'm like, oh, and then I skipped forward more. So I'm sorry. I will not have much to contribute to this.
All right, well, why don't we be more chronological about it and start at the beginning part of the episode when Saru goes to visit Tyler in sickbay.
Okay, yeah, that sounds
and
good.
Tyler tells Saru that, you know, Vok, even though Vok apparently he senses Vok's, he has Vok's memories, I think, or something along those lines. He's aware of Vok's history and his experiences, but he's not Vok. He is whoever he is now. Is he Tyler? I don't know. I'm not sure he knows either. But he convinces Saru that he's somewhat mentally stable.
Yeah.
And Saru thinks it's a good idea to give him a wristband so he could walk around the ship freely.
Yeah, an ankle monitor, basically.
Yeah, essentially an ankle monitor.
Yeah.
Which seems incredibly reckless to me.
Just bonkers. Yeah. Right? I mean, he killed somebody, right? He didn't have a PTSD.
And nearly killed someone
flashback.
Else.
Yeah. Yeah, this is a guy who maybe he shouldn't be in the brig, but at least he should be under house arrest or something.
Yeah, yeah. Like, put him in, like, you know, decent-sized quarters and have him chill out. Anyway.
Yeah, I agree. It's weird.
So they decide to do that. I thought that was crazy, and you guys clearly do too. But obviously, if they left him in the brig or in quarters, we wouldn't have anything for him to do. It'd be kind of lame for him to just cut to him sitting in his quarters doing nothing, yeah. I guess.
Well, so. You know what? What kind of gets me is, like, we as fans can have a conversation about what should be done with him. And that we've just done that in a very superficial sense, you know, in the last 30 seconds about the different options for him and what would be right or wrong. Like, shouldn't Starfleet officers be, like, struggling with this? Shouldn't it just seems like there's this huge opportunity to tell a very Star Trek story, which is you have this new kind of being that's been created. It's not really Tyler. It's not really Vok. Who is he? Is he a danger to the ship? But also, you know, he's an innocent and he's a victim in some ways. You know, what are his rights in the situation? It's something that Star Trek has tackled before in different ways. Why is there no room in Discovery, it seems, for those kinds of conversations?
Yeah, there was an episode of TNG called The Hunted, which was explicitly about this.
Or even, like, look at, like, Measure of a Man. There's another example of one way to sort of tackle that, like, from the human rights kind of side of things.
Oh, okay.
Yep.
You know what I mean? I mean, there's a million that I think that you could pick. But I think it's confounding to me that no one even mentions it.
Yeah, that is odd. Although, Tilly does kind of mention it later, that he's not really Vok, he's not really Tyler, he's kind of a new being, and that's why he needs to be taken care of and looked after, kind of a thing.
I guess so. It just feels...
But you don't see it, though. But you don't see that,
right,
though.
It's tell...
What you
it's
see
said,
is kind of a whacked-out Tyler.
It's they say it, but they don't show it.
Yeah, well, that's a whole other story. That's That's de rigueur for Star Trek Discovery.
Yeah.
Is to tell you things and not show them to you.
Yeah, so. I agree. And to show you perhaps the opposite, because throughout the episode, you can kind of tell when a writer wants you to feel a certain way about a character or about a situation. And it's very clear that the writers want us to feel like Tyler is this innocent guy and we should just be friends with him and everything's okay. And right. It's like, on the one hand, I like the optimism, you know, good job, you guys. I like that you're trying to recognize that part of it.
Yeah.
But what about the struggle? Like you should be able to have challenging conversations.
Yeah. Saru's decision comes from a good place. He means well.
Yeah.
But boy, oh boy.
But Tyler could, I mean, he not only could he potentially be a threat to other people, he could be a threat to himself, right?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, we don't know.
I mean, I
nobody knows. Like it's uncharted territory.
Yeah, it seems like it makes sense for him to just stay in sick bay.
Yeah, like he should be. Yeah, you would think he'd be monitored pretty much nonstop. I mean, as soon as he comes out of the coma, Saru goes to see him and is like, "Yeah, I think it's okay for you to walk around the ship." So,
yeah,
but I don't know.
Let's move on from that. Like, let's assume, okay, you know what? It was a plot device so that he could interact with people.
Okay.
And then, like, you know, assuming that, move on from there. I think, because I feel like we wouldn't be stuck on this point if it weren't for all the other things.
Right.
If no, it I was, agree. if this was in a vacuum, that's all that had happened, we'd be like, eh, whatever, it was a plot device. But yeah, what I was saying earlier is can we move to the mess hall scene?
Well, I think we should, before we do that, though, we should talk about the Stamets. That yes. happens right before
yeah.
the
yeah, no, that's great. Yeah. I kind of liked the Stamets' reaction to Tyler.
Me too. Yes. Yeah, so anyway, Tyler's walking down, gets near the mess hall. Presumably, he was going in to eat, and Stamets happens to be walking out at that moment. And Stamets has what I would consider a very controlled, mature reaction.
Mm. Yeah. Yeah.
To something that is so horrific that no one would blame him if he went crazy and just started beating on Tyler, but he kind of chastises him in a kind of a rough way and then walks away. Like, he doesn't make a scene about it.
Yeah. It's
actually my favorite scene in the entire episode. I really liked it. I really liked the way Stamets handled it.
Yeah, I totally agree.
Anyway, Tyler goes into the mess hall and obviously he's ostracized. Everybody on the ship knows that what he did, and he goes to sit down. He's sitting by himself, and Tilly sees him sitting alone, just like she saw Burnham, and she goes and sits with him. And as soon as she does that, she's like the Pied Piper, and then everybody starts coming to sit down with him. And
hey, man, how you been?
Yeah, bro, where you been, man?
I heard you killed a dude. What's up with that?
Yeah, Burnham, she's still got the marks on her throat, bro.
Yeah.
It was very odd. I mean, I know Tilly felt bad for him and everything, but my God.
I believed the Tilly going and sitting with him. I thought that was fine. But the everyone else coming and joining. And then they were all they almost looked like they were like I remember it in my mind is them patting him on the back and everybody laughing. Like that was the feeling, right?
Yeah, yeah, and it,
somebody
it
called
felt
it like an
it felt
after
like
school,
high school
special.
Yeah.
Yeah,
it was very weird, and it kind of sent like a weird message to me. Like, I don't know, I thought that was very odd. And like, you know, Stamets had just walked out of there. If Stamets actually witnessed that,
right?
He'd be like,
guys,
shit.
What the heck? Like,
yeah. Yeah, if Burnham happened to walk in, get hungry and walk in on that, like, she'd be like, what?
Yeah.
Like, I don't know.
I like the Starfleetness of, you know, of taking the more optimistic view of it, you know, and trying to be supportive of this guy who, because in a large way, he is a victim of the situation.
Yes, of course.
As much
he is.
As
yes, of course
the people
he is.
Who Vok killed. So, you know, on the one hand, I like that, but I feel like it's too forced, and it feels like it's too much of trying to force me to feel like I'm friends with him. And everything's okay when it's I don't know. It's just, it makes me uneasy, I guess.
Yeah, it seems like if this were TNG instead of the after school specialness of that scene, it would have been him having a conversation with Counselor Troy. right? Which maybe would be a little more appropriate, because who knows how he's going to react to this kind of stimuli, right? I mean, who knows? What if he orders Plomeek soup and it's not warm enough and he flips out on everybody, right?
Right.
Yeah, because we're just trusting that our prisoner, Laurel, who orchestrated this whole thing, has actually, like, removed Vok and didn't just, like, you know, use some new kind of spy tactic. You know, who knows what she did to him? We have no idea.
And the reception that he gets is contrary to the one Burnham got. Burnham got the stink eye from everybody when she first came aboard.
For a long time.
Yeah, for a fair amount of time. And then, obviously, everybody mellowed out with her, too, and everything was groovy. But there's definitely a difference in the way he was accepted immediately back into the fold, despite his deeds, and Burnham wasn't.
Yeah, Burnham didn't kill someone by snapping their neck.
Yeah, so there's kind
of
just...
Yeah, Burnham's main crime was just an error of judgment, right? Not murder. Anyway.
And it came from
We're probably harping on it for too long, but it stood out to all of us.
It seemed unnecessary. It felt kind of like filler, and like they should have been doing something else.
Yeah.
Anyway.
Yeah, anyway.
And then there's Jared's favorite scene that he didn't watch.
Yes.
Which is the Tyler Burnham moment, which is like...
Jared was so emotionally invested in it that he skipped it.
Sorry, it's just... I you know, it's watching a relationship inventory with two people I don't care about at all.
Yeah, no.
I keep coming back to feeling like it was a soap opera.
Yeah. Yeah, and a poorly constructed one at that.
Which they often are.
I don't, and this goes back to a problem I have with Discovery, the way Discovery writes its characters in general. I don't believe in their relationship.
Yeah.
It's been developed enough. I don't feel like the relationship is developed enough yet where we're seeing all these emotional histrionics when we haven't witnessed to like this deep connection. At least I haven't. I think that's the part of the problem. I harped on this last week too, and I've said it in other podcasts about this show. Is that there's not enough time to develop things. Like there's just constant need to rush to the next thing. So you end up being told these things and you're not shown them. So when we get to like this big emotional moment between these two, it's important for the characters clearly, but for us, did anybody really care all that much?
No, and when you consider that the other emotionally weighty matter in this episode is tens of thousands, if not, you know, maybe more, people being murdered by Klingons, that we don't get anything beyond about that except a PowerPoint, it seems kind of like a weird decision. Thank you, Kayla. A space PowerPoint.
Space PowerPoint. It totally is.
It is. But like, when Burnham goes to visit Tilly and they're kibitzing in the lab, and you know, Tilly pushes Burnham to go see him, and she says, you know, he's lost the person he cared about the most. I'm like, really? Really? Burnham is like the center of his universe? How long have they known each other? Like, I was talking to Matt today about that. I was like, we're trying to figure out how long the storyline's actually been going on for. He thinks it's been 2 or 3 months, but I can't really tell.
Well, to be fair, Tyler's only, what, like a year old? So,
Yeah,
she is the most important thing in his universe.
Yeah, but I just feel like, again, it just feels like...
I kind of liked the Tilly thing, to be honest.
Not Tilly's thing, but it's just like this idea, like the idea that she thinks it's a good idea for her to go see him. I agree.
I thought like that was kind of awesome of Tilly to be like, hey, actually, I'm going to sort of, because she's flipping the roles there, being a mentor to Burnham. And, you know, and usually Burnham had been this mentor to Tilly. So it was cool to see her kind of man up and be like, look, dude, like, you need to go say whatever you're going to say to him, even if it's goodbye, you got to do it. Yeah. You have to man up and you got to grow up and do this.
No, and I could, and that was good advice, and she was absolutely correct.
Yeah, I agree. Yeah. So I liked that. That, like, so, like you mentioned earlier, the moment with Stamets and then the moment with Tilly were two of my favorite points.
But the showdown between the two of them didn't really resonate completely with me.
I'm not sure what it accomplished, I guess. Where are we left after that conversation?
Yeah. And then, you know, at the end of their conversation, I mean, clearly he feels like she should be there to support him and that she's using his condition as a means of copping out in the relationship, which was kind of a crazy thing to me.
Yeah, but I could see someone saying it. I could see someone being emotional and saying that.
Yeah, yeah. But she feels like it's, you know, it's, this is the kind of work you have to do yourself. Like, you have to...
Which,
you know,
I also was like, why?
Yeah, I didn't understand that part of it either. I actually copied this bit down because it says a lot about Burnham. She says, after the battle of the binary stars, I was so lost. I had to sit with myself. I had to work through it. I had to crawl my way back. I'm still not there, but I'm trying. That kind of work, reclaiming life, is punishing, and it's relentless, and it's solitary. Now, if she had actually gone through that kind of a journey, we actually witnessed that journey, that those words would have a great deal of resonance to me. But you never, outside like the first two episodes, like, you know, after the pilot hours, like, so after like episodes 3 and 4, she mostly just becomes a member of the crew.
Yeah. Yeah, I know. When we were told that she was going to be the main character, no. You know,
so she's giving the speech to him about, you know, working your way back. And like, I wanted, once, and I've said this before, once they put her on this course, Burnham, that she was going to be this compromised character that was going to have to redeem herself. All right, that's, you know, that's an interesting journey to set your the show's main character up to be.
Right.
But they start doing that, and then the Lethe episode, which is the one with Sarek in it, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
She goes to her little journey. She has a cathartic moment in relation to how, you know, her relationship with Sarek, and then all of a sudden she, like, a personality switch kicks in, and from there on out it feels like she was just another member of the crew.
Hmm.
There were times during the season where I kind of forgot that she was a criminal.
Yeah. A mutineer.
That she's a mutineer. She's technically, you know, been busted. She has no rank. It's hard to tell sometimes because it doesn't feel like she's being punished in any way.
I don't know.
To hear her going on about giving him a lecture about reclaiming your life kind of rang hollow with me because I haven't seen her do that.
Well, yeah, and that kind of comes back to something I keep thinking about, which is something that I alluded to at the beginning of the podcast when I was echoing you, Brian, saying that I feel like there's all these threads that haven't been resolved. Because for me, I'm trying to figure out what this show is about. You know, what is Discovery about? And we were told a lot of things that it was going to be about before it aired. And we've been kind of, those have been sprinkled in, the hints of those things. There's one more episode, you know, so I'm still, like, I'm going to be totally fair and say, you know, I'm not gonna judge the whole season until I see all of it, which will be after next week. But but as of this moment, you know, I don't feel like it's been this season has been about Burnham's journey, because there's plenty of episodes that have nothing to do with that or with Burnham really at all. Then it was about the mirror universe for a little while. And then it was also like about the Klingon War. But then when they got to the mirror universe, it's like, we didn't even care about that. And now we're back and now it's about the war again. But so I'm just like, I'm not sure what the message is. I'm not sure what the common thread is. I'm not sure like which of these narratives I'm supposed to be following.
Yeah. The other thing is, part of the idea of a serialized storytelling is that you have some through line that you go through. And this is like, not like the moral of the story, but that's just the theme.
Yeah. I mean, what, like, is that? What's the motif?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, like, okay, like with the first season of Game of Thrones, it starts with our hero, Ned Stark, beheading this guy from the Night's Watch who, you know, has broken his vow. And then it ends with Ned Stark about to be sent off to the Night's Watch being beheaded, right? So there's this idea, this guy who, according to his standards of nobility and honor, does something that's actually kind of awful, and then the same thing kind of happens to him at the end, right? So there's this kind of this theme that goes through it, right? Of what does justice mean? What does honor mean? And it fits really, really well. Thematically, it works from start to finish that first season. But if you were to ask me to summarize something like that for this first season, I would have no idea where to start. I would say, gosh, Saru's really tall and cool, and I like when his threat ganglia come out.
Yeah.
Yeah, same. I think this is something that, like I said, we're going to see, we're going to see another hour of the show next week, and we're going to talk about it right here on the podcast. I think we'll really get to chew on that a bit. You know, what was the theme of the show? But I think the reason I bring it up is because, you know, what you guys are saying about this scene between Tyler and Burnham not holding any weight for you, I think the way that I feel about it is I would agree with that, and I would say it's because, you know, as you've said, we haven't really seen the relationship develop to the point where they're telling us it has developed to. So they're saying, oh, yeah, it's gotten to this amazing place, but they haven't really shown us that. And I feel like that's part of that. It's a symptom of this larger issue that I have, which is just the difficulty in finding what is the heart of this show.
Yeah.
So
it's a fair question.
Like I said, reserving judgment until next week. Yep. That's not necessarily meant to be a criticism of the entire season until next week. So
that's right. That's right.
The other major part of this episode was probably the Admiral Cornwell and Giorgio, that whole thing, that whole story. Mm-hmm.
Okay, I just want to jump on this to say I really like Admiral Cornwell. I really like the actress who's playing her. Jane Brooke is her name.
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
I think she carries the role with the gravitas that I find believable of someone who's ascended to this high rank in a military organization. And they say, like, there's a speculation in her backstory that, like, she was a psychiatrist before she advanced into command, and that's what guides some of her interactions with people. And that's believable as you look back at it. That's a theory that fits the facts, to quote Spock from Undiscovered Country. And I like that they can do that kind of thing with the character without having to spell it out, right? That's the opposite of what we've been complaining about. That's showing, not telling, right? That's just putting it there and not having to hang a lantern on it. I really like her, and I'm glad that they're capitalizing on this great actress in a good role. I haven't seen her in anything else for the longest time. I actually thought she was someone else. I thought she was this actress Cherry Jones. I don't know if you guys are familiar with her. She was on that Nosedive episode of Black Mirror last year. But I really like the performance they're doing with this. I hope we get to see more of her. I also like that we have a Starfleet admiral who is neither incompetent nor a traitor.
Yeah.
But that we know of. She may be a traitor. That may be the twist.
Yeah, you never know.
Yeah.
I have to agree. I think Admiral Cornwell may be my favorite character.
Oh,
and I love the interactions between her and Laurel.
Oh, okay, good.
Yeah.
That was actually, I'm going to revise my previous statement. I've already changed my mind. I think that was my favorite scene, was the Admiral Cornwell and Laurel scene, because I just think they're so awesome playing off of each other, those two characters.
Mm, yeah. Yeah, they are. They are. I agree.
And Admiral Cornwell doesn't take no shit from no one.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I like that she tells it like it is.
Yep. Straight shooter.
Yeah.
And let's see what else happened with Cornwell. Oh, we finally got a briefing room scene.
Mm.
In true Star Trek fashion.
Yeah, it wouldn't be a Star Trek show if you didn't have a briefing room scene.
With the space PowerPoint.
Yep, space PowerPoint. There's some cool holograms that come up.
Beautiful holograms.
Yep, and then we get, you know, a lot of exposition about what's happened to the Federation in the 9 months that the Discovery was away.
Yeah, can we talk about that for a minute?
Sure.
Because I think it's important, this nine months. And I was confused about it at the end of last week's episode, and I'm still kind of confused about it now, because you guys can correct me if I'm wrong, but as far as I'm aware, nothing like this has ever been talked about in canon. No one's ever been like, hey, do you remember that one time that like a huge chunk of the Federation was taken over and the Klingons like got really close to destroying Earth?
Massacred
tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands, maybe at this point, of people.
Yeah, I was writing down as she was rattling off, like, they were rattling off all those numbers. Mm-hmm. And let me see. She says the casualties are up to one third of the fleet, which is a lot of people. 20% of former Federation space is occupied. And on Starbase 1, the incident at Starbase 1 killed 80,000 people.
Hmm. And that's just a Starbase.
Starfleet. That's Starfleet.
Not a populated world.
No, Starbase One, when they went, according to Cornwell, there were 80,000 people on Starbase One that the Klingons massacred.
Yeah.
And that's just one incident.
So it's just, I find it difficult, you know, like I feel like I've spent this whole season waiting for these holes to be filled.
Yeah.
And this seems, and like I mentioned earlier in the podcast, the spore drive thing is a big one for me personally. You know, when are they going to tell us how this thing can't ever be used again? But this is a big one too, right?
It is. This is something that was already a big thing in this season and has now actually become something bigger because it appears that this war is taking a horrifying toll on Starfleet. To the point where it seems like there might be hundreds of thousands of Starfleet officers that are dead, or people from member worlds, and like
And this is just a few years before the Cage, too,
right?
Yeah, and it just seems odd to have had a battle of such an unbelievable scale with such an amazing cost of life that never really gets referred to much after that. Like, to create this giant event, which is, I guess, essentially the World War II of Star Trek.
Mm.
Yeah, yeah. And so unless they have some reset button, which would be dumb, right? It'd be stupid if they're like, oh, just kidding. We used the spore drive to, like, jump back in time and undo everything. You know, unless they had some big undo button.
Yeah, Matt thinks they do.
Well, yeah, one theory that had been kicked around, didn't Matt say, was that what we've been seeing in Discovery actually is the mirror universe, right? And so it's a parallel dimension. And then once they actually went to the mirror universe, that was wrong, right? But that would be the easiest reset button, would be the parallel universe.
That nothing mattered.
Yeah, we'll see. We'll see how they try to play it. But yeah, to introduce a conflict at this enormous scale like this with the loss of life they're describing so close to the events of the original series is very questionable.
There's also, and again, my through line for this episode is harping on the fact that they haven't earned it. There's a lot of saying things that are big rather than just doing something that's great, which kind of speaks to desperation in a lot of ways. And the thing that, like, I mean, talking about, oh, look how huge this conflict is. Oh, so many people are bad. The scale is so big. That means it's good, right, if it's big. It kind of reminds me of that scene in The Force Awakens where they say, here's a picture of the original Death Star, and here's the Starkiller base. And, like, it's 10 times bigger. It's like we're supposed to say, oh, that makes it better.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, like, did you guys see Blade Runner 2049?
Yes.
Like, I love that the climax was just a couple people fighting in the rain, and that was it. Mm-hmm. Same as the original movie. It didn't have to be...
Yeah, same as the original.
It didn't have to be thousands of robots attacking and a big laser shooting out of the sky. The nature of the conflict emotionally meant so much that it didn't matter that it was huge.
That's right. I'm going to throw this in there just because I didn't get to talk about last week's episode with you guys, but this reminds me so much of a feeling I had last week where Stamets is explaining that if the mycelial network collapses, it will be the end to all life as we know it in the entire universe. In all the universes.
Multiverse. Yeah, the multiverse.
All the multiverses, all life in all multiverses will cease to exist. Mm. And they like...
Crisis on Infinite Earths.
Yeah, they kind of like threw that in there. And then it was like, wait, you guys, this is like measurably... the biggest thing that anyone in any story ever has ever faced. You know what I mean? Like, it's so huge, and they kind of just like threw it in there and were like, oh, good thing we averted all life and all universes being destroyed. Like, whew, it's all in a day's work.
Yeah.
You know, I just felt like that. I just felt like I really agree with what you're saying. I found it jarring when he's on the bridge going, oh, it's, you know, he's almost even joking about it, which you can say that's his character, but I found it strange. He's like, oh yeah, you know, and all it means is, you know, just destruction of all the life in the universe and all universes. And it's like, okay, well, you're telling us that it's this huge threat, but, and then it just gets resolved magically as well.
Yeah. Well, everything involving the Spore Drive is powered by magic.
Yeah. Yeah, apparently.
It's true. I mean, the Spore Drive has its intrigues, but it really does feel like a piece of magic.
I think, yeah, while we're talking about the Spore Drive, we can't, we would be remiss if we did not talk about, we're talking about it being magic, we'd be remiss if we did not talk about the Spore terraforming.
Yeah.
Take us to the whatever system and get ready for a show. I'm not going to tell you guys my plan, by the way. We're just going to do it.
Yeah,
but that's just a TV trope. Drama. That's just a TV trope, though. But okay, yeah. So we thought that they had discovered a way, the writers, to close the hole and get rid of the Spore Drive and explain why no one could ever use it again, because they zoomed back into our universe and found out, oh, this thing is actually super dangerous and crazy, and also we just like burned up all of our spores, so we can't jump anymore. Just kidding. I have one little plant left that I was saving for a special occasion. And I also happen to have a bunch of terraforming technology, which is
readily available.
Readily available. And all these little probes just ready to go. And a whole, I even have a target planet picked out. And it has the right conditions to host mycelium spores. And I have. I guess he split that one into like a bunch of smaller ones and then launched it out on these probes that they just happen to have laying around. And like, as far as we know in canon, no one has terraformed anything before, right? In that way.
No. As far as we know, Genesis Device was the first time anybody could do something like that.
Right.
But that doesn't mean, obviously, that somebody couldn't do it. It's not the same kind of terraforming as Genesis.
Yeah, but it's... Yeah, but it was... I mean, it's pretty similar.
Yeah, well, it's similar in the sense that it the spores take over the planet quickly and create their own environment. Yeah, they do it instantly because, well, yeah.
I'm the scientist in the room and I hated it.
But Genesis is a more sophisticated thing.
It is, and even that is kind of ridiculous, but it's more.
Oh, of course it is.
It's more of a. It's more of a MacGuffin in that it's like all it does is move the plot along. When this is like you couldn't have the next piece of the story without this event in Discovery. Like they had to just come up with a way to get him to use the Spore Drive again, and they just like put this Band-Aid on it. You know, it wasn't like, you know, it's integral to the plot for the plot to move from point A to point B. You have to have this occur. When I felt like with the Genesis device, you know, it didn't have to be that. You know what I mean? So it was more of a story device for me than this was.
Interesting.
If that makes sense.
This didn't bother me that much, to be honest with you. I mean, you're the scientist, and I will concede to your expertise in this matter, but it didn't bother me particularly. Did it obviously remind, I think it reminded me, you, and everybody else about Genesis, but...
But, like, here's this, too. The Genesis device, they had spent, like, a ton of time with a huge team of people, like, coming up with the perfect planet to do this on and, you know, doing all these tests and doing, like, there's all this background work that went into it. And here it's like, it's like Stamets rolled out of bed and was like, hey, let's just, like, terraform this planet.
It's true.
Like, they can just do that. Like, I'm just not convinced that Starfleet can just, like, decide to terraform a planet and then do it later that afternoon.
Yeah. It also dramatically... If they make this big deal about how you can't use it ever again, and then you say, oh, wait, we can't use it ever again unless we do this one little thing that will take 3 minutes.
Right, which is apparently super easy. Yeah.
It robs it of a lot of its drama. The thing it reminds me of is, for example, killing your captain, expecting it to have dramatic impact, and then bringing him back to life with magic blood 2 seconds later.
Yep.
Yeah.
It's the magic con blood effect.
Yep. Well, I will say the spore effect, the effects that they did for it and everything was very cool.
Oh, the visual effects?
Oh, absolutely.
Effects?
Looked beautiful.
Yeah, the visuals were beautiful.
I couldn't see them.
It was
my
gorgeous,
eyes were
I tell you.
Hard.
Gorgeous.
I'm sorry.
They rolled out of her head onto the floor and down the hall.
Yeah. No, it was really pretty. It looked really cool. But I was just...
Yeah, it was very well done.
It just seemed like... I don't know. The moment didn't land for me, let's say that.
No.
Fair enough. Fair enough. All right.
Okay. Can I complain about while we're talking about magic technology? Can I complain about something?
Yes.
Okay. Right, so Klingons of this era should not have cloaking devices. Cloaking device was the masterpiece of the Romulan arsenal, and it was what made them so elusive. But they had like less effective ships in other ways. Then the thing that made them so dangerous is then there was this alliance between the Klingons and the Romulans, and they shared their technology. And the Klingons said, "Hey, you could have our big awesome ships," and the Romulans said, "Hey, you could have our cloaking devices." So it's a huge violation of canon for the Klingons to be using cloaking devices, and it's one of those things where like there's the weight of the many years of the franchise where they're saying, "Oh, well, the Klingons have always had cloaking devices." But they're missing, like, the details of the franchise. The other problem is it's very clearly shown in here what an amazing tactical advantage unrestricted cloaking gives the Klingons. And I like where Admiral Cornwell is going through all these episodes where it's used to give the Klingons an amazing upper hand. She even mentions, like, a suicide bomber type of thing where they were able to, you know, because they can't shoot while they're cloaked. But that doesn't mean that they're restricted from any other type of attack of any kind, right? And so the idea of, like, some of these warriors who want to do a suicide run while they're cloaked to take advantage of somebody when their shield's down makes a lot of sense. But the thing is, if the cloak is really that good, then there's no reason that the Federation would not eventually have developed that same technology as well, which we know is a huge piece of canon that explains that the Federation explicitly not to agree in a treaty with the Romulans to develop this kind of thing. But anyway, it just... It drives me bonkers.
No, I think it's important what you're saying.
Yeah.
Because we were told, you know, it's again this thing of like we were told that there was going to be this like super attention to that kind of detail.
Yeah.
Yeah, and that's a big
detail. That's a big one. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And it's something where it's at odds with itself, right? They're contradicting themselves.
Well, and at the beginning of the season, I remember us talking about the cloaking device that I guess that T'Kuvma had, and we were kind of like, well, it's not really canon, but well, it's just this one ship, so it's sort of an isolated incident, and like that. We could see that fits.
Yeah, yeah,
yeah. Yep. And now that's completely, you can't use that excuse anymore because the entire Klingon race seems to have cloaking devices now. So now it's a problem for canon.
Yeah, it's a huge problem. I mean, in Balance of Terror, when they run into that bird of prey, they have to. It took them a while to figure out what a cloaking device is and how to circumvent it and everything else. The Enterprise has not run into it before. So
it's just prequels. You really, if you wanted to make it work, you have to be really careful with it. You have to be really smart about it, and that's not what we're seeing here.
I keep thinking, what if they really do have a big reset button next week?
But if they do, then what was the point of the whole season?
I know. I totally agree. I hate reset buttons. Because it means, haha, nothing matters. That's what that says to me, is nothing matters.
Yeah, it invalidates everything that you watched and potentially got emotionally invested in.
And I think the tiny bit of disagreement I'll have is I think that a reset button kind of thing can work. It was all just a dream, can work, if it's done tongue-in-cheek and if it's very humorous, right? Like in a comedy, they do that. Like there's that one episode, and Matt's not here to appreciate this. There's that one episode of Simpsons that they reveal that Principal Skinner actually isn't Principal Skinner. He's actually somebody else who took Principal Skinner's identity in Vietnam War and came back and assumed his life. And then at the end, they just make a big joke out of it and say, and the judge decrees that no one else will ever bring this up ever again, right? Where they're really winking at the audience.
Yeah, but exactly.
There's absolutely no way that would fit with the tone, the dour tone of this show, for them to do something, to do it comedically.
No.
Oh, wait. Okay, maybe what they'll do is they'll reveal that this was all just an exercise on the holodeck with Riker and Troy.
Ah! Oh, my God. Oh, my God. I kind of hope so. That would be the only way that they could be like, just kidding, this whole show was a comedy. It was the long con.
Yeah, and now they're not 10 years older than when the Pegasus aired. Now they're 25 years older, but they still cram them into those uniforms and try to make it work.
Yes, please. Please make that be the finale. Can someone, if someone out there is listening who's like really good at this kind of thing, can someone like make an alternate ending and put it on YouTube where Riker and Troy coming in saying computer and program? Because that would be so
You could absolutely do that. If you like rotoscope them, you could totally do that.
Someone please do it.
Yeah, that is totally doable. Anyway, hopefully, I really hope they don't do that.
I do.
I really hope they don't press the reset button.
Yeah, yeah. It's just like at this point, I'm racking my brain thinking of what other way is there to, because there's so many loose ends. How do they wrap them all up in 60 minutes?
Unless they're going to, maybe they'll figure out a way to distort the timeline.
That seems so like a reset button too, though.
Yeah, yes and no, but maybe it resets certain things, but not others. Sure.
That, like maybe Burnham quantum leaps back into herself right before the Battle of Binary Stars, so she's unchanged, but everyone else is.
Or, maybe.
No. Yeah. So she.
Although I do have a theory about what the ending of the season is going
to
be.
Do you want to share it now, or do you want to wait?
I'll tell you now. I think that, obviously, we haven't gotten into the whole Giorgio thing yet, but we all know, anybody who's listening to this, obviously she's now captain of the Discovery, and they're going to go on a mission, and I think somewhere along the line, she's going to do something really messed up, because she's an evil, vile creature.
Uh-huh.
And Michael and gang are going to mutiny. They're going to suppress whatever she's trying to do. Whatever they end up doing will ultimately stop the war, and Burnham will be redeemed.
So she mutinies by prime Giorgio and starts the war, and then she mutinies Mira Giorgio to end the war.
Yeah.
Yeah.
There's some bookends.
That's their idea of like some sort of bookend. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think there's a decent chance that'll happen.
That's a good theory.
It is a good theory. It is a very good theory.
Very plausible.
I think we're getting to the point where we have to talk about this really important part of the episode, Giorgio. Yes. We haven't even talked about Giorgio yet. We're already
To segue into Giorgio.
Yeah, consider us segued.
All right.
A few things to unpack here, huh? So, where do we start?
Well, first of all, we obviously find out that the war has obviously gone very badly for the Federation Starfleet. As we discussed earlier, body counts are very high, lots of ships destroyed. The Federation is in a compromised position to the point where it appears that the war will be lost unless something is done. And they don't seem to have the ability to figure out what to do on their own.
Starfleet tactics have failed us.
Yeah, so it's an exact quote from Sarek, I believe.
Mm-hmm. And, like, I guess I see his point, but at the same time, like, I just feel like sort of abandoning your core principles maybe is going a little bit too far. Like he says Starfleet tactics have failed us. Okay, it's one thing to change your tactics, right, and get some other outside perspectives, but they decide that the solution to this is to put Giorgio basically in charge of their strategy.
I think I mentioned this last week. I'm going to say it again. I don't know how. I mean, she's not Major Kira, who is used to fighting a no-win type scenario. This is someone who's always been in charge of an empire that's always dominated everybody, right? I don't understand why her tactical insights would mean anything in the situation.
Yeah, I don't get it.
Well, I guess there's the idea that she had conquered the Klingons in her universe, and so
yeah. But her brilliant concept though is basically let's go to Kronos and beat the shit out of
them. Right. Yeah. Exactly. And that there is this piece of the plan that they're holding over our heads that we don't know what it is. The secret piece of the plan that Sarek is apparently going somewhere very dangerous, to deal with. And it's the thing that convinced them to let her be the captain. When she said, because she's bargaining for her freedom, essentially. She's like, I gave Burnham a little taste of my strategy. But that's not really how you're going to win. You're going to get nowhere with that. If you want the real story, I've got it for you, but you got to give me my freedom. Okay, I'm on board with that, story-wise. What surprised me was the fact that they decided to parade her as Prime Giorgio. Because
massive deception.
Not only are they saying, I mean, you could make arguments because we don't really know what her plan is. So you could say that our feeling that they're abandoning their principles. You know, you could argue that that's short sighted if you want. But what you can't argue with is how messed up it is to put that woman in that position, in that uniform, and parade her around as the original, because there are plenty of people on that ship, apart from Burnham, who lost that captain already.
Yeah, the navigator with the headpiece, she lost her too.
Yeah, and I think they show her a reaction shot of her. And
yeah,
she
they
looks
do.
Sort of distraught.
It looked like
she's smiling. Good. She's like smiling. She's thrilled to see her. It's like, oh, jeez.
Okay. The other thing though is not only, you know, we may say like, is this right for them to lie to people like that? But they're also lying to a group of people who know that the mirror universe is a thing because they've been there and understand that there are duplicates for people.
And understand that Giorgio was the emperor.
Yeah, exactly. This is not someone they just snatched and said, oh, maybe we can sneak this person by them. No, they all know that this is a thing. Yeah.
Good point. Are they stupid? Good point.
Well, I guess we're going to find out.
Good point. But I don't know. I thought it was messed up. I thought it was incredibly... What's the word I'm looking for? Just like, you know, have a little bit of empathy for these people and what they've been through. It just seemed completely uncaring.
Yeah, just very manipulative.
Yeah.
I have to go back, though, to saying, like, the fact that they need her at all seems bizarre to me.
Oh, I agree.
The idea that Starfleet doesn't have any good captains capable of leading people into combat. Like, Garth of Izar was known.
Yeah.
For that was his famous legend, I believe, that he won this famous engagement against the Klingons. Remember earlier in the season when they had that screen where they had all those lists of, you know, acting captains or whatever?
That's right.
The most decorated captains.
The most decorated captains. Christopher Pike. Matt Decker. Like, all these people that we know are active.
Oh,
and
yeah.
And are active 10 years later.
That's true.
So what are they doing?
And Robert April.
So what are they doing?
Yeah.
Robert April.
Yeah, good point.
Like, these are all, like, legendary commanders within Starfleet. What are they doing during the war? Are they in like, I don't understand, like...
Well, and it goes back to, you know, the attention to detail with the canon, because, you know, it was revealed that the reason that Lorca, that they wrote Lorca to be from the Mirror Universe is that he was originally conceived by Brian Fuller to be this character who had this great, you know, military expertise and was good at war. And the writers later decided that, wouldn't it make more sense if he was from the Mirror Universe? Because, you know, how can you be from Starfleet, from this peaceful, you know, organization and have so much knowledge about war when they're, you know, when they've always been in peacetime, really? And then you just rattle off a bunch of names that, like, show within Star Trek's own canon that there were plenty of commanding officers that have military prowess. So it just seems like another one of these details that's somehow lost. I'm not going to say ignored, because that implies some kind of intent, but I think, you know, to me it doesn't come across that it seems like that detail of canon wasn't really honored.
Yeah, I think they decided this, they wanted to tell this story, and they were going to tell the story. So anyway, so we've got this genocidal mass murderer now wearing a Starfleet uniform in command of the Federation's most advanced ship. So we went from one Mirror Universe commander to another one.
Right. Yeah. Great. To a worse one.
Yeah. Much worse. Yeah. One who eats threat ganglia.
Yeah. So it doesn't speak well to the Federation, and, well, not so much the Federation, but Starfleet itself. And if her leadership were to ultimately lead to an everlasting peace, the notion that peace that we've seen, that we've enjoyed in the Star Trek universe, was because of someone like that is terrible.
Yeah.
Well, that, okay,
I mean, I don't think it's going to get to that. I don't think it'll get to that. But like, but if it does, like, wow.
The alternative is they capitalize on this woman's ruthlessness, and then once she's saved the day, they off her very quickly. I mean, that's not very good either, right?
No, it's not.
No, I don't think she's going to survive the episode.
There's though. No way. There's no way.
No. No.
Dead Captain Walking.
Dead Captain Walking again.
Part two.
The first double red shirting in Star Trek history.
perhaps.
Anyway, it'll be interesting to see how they work their way out of what they've set up.
Yeah,
they got a lot to cover in the next. I assume that it being the finale, I'm guessing this one will be longer than most of the others.
True, fair point. It's just It seems like there's so much that needs to be resolved.
Yeah, I would guess this is going to be an hour, maybe a little more.
Yeah.
Did you guys watch the next week on Star Trek Discovery?
We did indeed.
I did not.
I did not.
Oh, I thought you looked. Yeah, okay.
No, you can tell me about it, though. I don't mind, actually.
Well, they clearly go on some sort of, you know, Burnham and Tyler and I think Giorgio and a couple other people go down to Kronos to be part of this mission.
Tyler?
Tyler. And there's a bunch, a lot of it came by quickly. They end up, looks like they're in a club at one point with a lot of people, half naked people dancing, and I don't know.
Do they have dancing girls that can catch butterflies with their tongues?
Yeah, a lot of it went by very quickly, so it was hard to really focus on much of it. So, I don't know. It definitely looks like there'll be a lot of action, though. They're clearly packing a lot into this last hour.
Yeah, they'd have to. There's no way they can't. Do you think they'll leave with a cliffhanger, or do you think they'll resolve stuff?
I think they'll leave with a cliffhanger.
Yeah, I think we'll probably get at least one more zinger.
Here's I know what this show is about, you guys.
What's it about?
Twists.
Oh.
It's about twists.
It's certainly in the final third of its season, it certainly is.
Yeah, the second half. Yeah, certainly the second part two of season one is.
Yeah, it's basically just been one reveal after the other. Yeah. Yeah,
you thought this was Giorgio. It's actually a horse.
Oh, the one thing I want to say is when Mirror Giorgio walked in the room, I wanted to see Saru's threat ganglia engage, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you would have thought... At one point, his ganglia did go up.
Did they? Maybe I just missed it.
I think it did go up, Jared.
Okay. Well, then honor is satisfied.
So, all in all, I feel like this episode was a bit messy. It seems like, you know, it didn't resolve a lot of threads for me that I was hoping were going to be resolved by this point. And, I think this episode and the last one were, like, it's been said already on this podcast, like, sort of, a lot of it was filler for me. It was probably my least favorite episode of the season so far.
Ouch.
Yeah. They can't all be winners.
That's true, they can't.
I think, three episodes ago now, was when they came into the Mirror Universe, it was fantastic. Fantastic.
Yeah, that first hour of the Mirror Universe was very good.
It was fun. It was charming.
I loved it. Loved it.
Yeah, that was a lot of fun.
And this, it's hard. This doesn't stack up to that level. So we'll see I don't know. I'm nervous for next week, but also curious.
Yes. And hopeful.
I try to remain hopeful.
Yes. Hope springs eternal, especially in the Star Trek universe.
Right, yeah. Right.
On that note, we will see you all next week when we will be talking about the season finale, which is called Will You Take My Hand?
What do you think is going to happen on Will You Take My Hand? Do you think someone's going to... I think it's Will You Take My Hand in Marriage, and Tyler's going to propose to Burnham.
I like that.
In the caves of Kronos.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, he'll be fighting. Is it Vok or is it Tyler? And there's Laurel on one side and there's Burnham on the other side. And it's like, you know, when you, like, put a treat out and you try to get the dog to come to you, you're like, who do you love more?
It's a love triangle built for four people.
Yep.
And on that note, we'll see you all next week.
Thanks for listening, guys. See you next week.
Yeah, thanks, everybody.
Bye, everybody.
Bye.
Bye-bye.